Attention, you're listening to The Antidote to Liberalism. The active ingredient in this program is common sense, which has been documented to prevent and even cure liberalism. Be advised that listening may cause you to lean to the right. The doctor will be with you momentarily. Here's your host, Todd Huff.
Well, the battle shots have been fired, that's for sure. There is an all-out war now over Donald Trump, over the Republican presidential nominee. And regardless, and we'll get into this today, regardless of your thoughts about who should be the president, excuse me, who is best to carry the banner of conservatism? Regardless of your specific thoughts and opinions on that, this is good. This is the sort of thing that needs to happen. We've come a long way. You know, I've been following politics since I was a teenager, and closely, I had an interest. It was something that I concerned myself with. You know, I've always been concerned with that. The two things you're not supposed to talk about, the two things that they tell you not to talk about, which is, in my opinion, the things that, look, you just shouldn't go around banging people over the head with these things or busting them in the face, but politics and religion. I mean, if on the religious side, I'm a Christian. I make no apologies for that. You don't have to be a Christian to agree with me. You don't have to be a Christian to listen to this show. But I'm a Christian. I believe that Jesus absolutely is the Son of God, that he came to earth to die for man's sins, and that he is the only way to God the Father and to live eternally in heaven with him. And I could explain multiple reasons why I think that. I won't do that in this show. Maybe some other time we can get into those things. It's another passion of mine. One that unfortunately has been, at least on the Christian apologetic side, is one that I've had to place on the back burner as life has just gotten to where I don't have the time for it at this point. I don't mean for God himself. I mean to really increase the study of apologetics. But my point is, this is the most important thing. Your belief in God or your belief in no God is the most important thing, because it determines what happens after you pass through this world. Now, for those who are atheists who believe that there is no afterlife, there is no God, once your body dies, that's it, the game's over, then that's fine. You can have that belief. But if my belief is that there are eternal consequences, that we were created in the image of God, I'm compelled to at least make that case known to you. I mean, if you were in my shoes, wouldn't you think if that was the truth of the universe, that you would want others to at least be aware of the consequences and be able to make their own decisions? So my point is, that's the most important thing, religion, God, coming to grips with that reality. But secondly, the second most important thing. Now, I'm glossing over family and personal affairs. I'm just talking about the things that have perhaps the biggest impact on the way we're able to live. The first is connecting with God. The second is creating a government, creating a society that is best to live as you take this journey through life. And I think it's undeniable that what we have established here in this nation, although it's been ignored by both parties, and this is important to note, I mean, on this program, the name of this program is The Antidote to Liberalism. And yes, by listening to this program, you may in fact be leaning to the right, because that is the home of most conservatives. Although you may have to say independent now, because a lot of folks can't even stomach, and I agree and am sympathetic to that, even though I still am a registered Republican. There are a lot of things I don't agree with the Republicans are on, overall, at large. You know, and you listen to some of the Republican candidates on stage at the debates, Jeb Bush, John Kasich, others. They don't sound like conservatives. They don't sound like those that are echoing. Now, this isn't a universal statement. Of course, some of the things that Jeb says or Kasich says or some of the others say are conservative, are constitutionally conservative. But if you're looking for conservative purists, someone who believes very closely to what the founders established, which is a government with limited powers, with clearly defined authorities among three equal branches, the executive branch, which is currently controlled, much to my dismay, by President Barack Obama, the legislative branch, which is currently controlled by the Republicans, both the House and the Senate, but they're not controlled by conservatives. And conservatives, ironically, get the blame for everything that doesn't go right. Because Congress has sold us a bill of goods. The politicians, I should say, the career politicians have sold us a bill of goods that says that government is there to solve every problem. And every time the conservatives say, let's, you know, remove government from this area, let's back off, let's cease to have control, and something doesn't go exactly as we want it, then conservatives are blamed because the government didn't do something about it, because that problem would have not been there, says the big government crowd, if the government was just given enough authority. And conveniently for the big government and the left, anytime any problem exists, the solution is always more government to them. Because they, of course, can fix everything. And this is a cancerous lie. This is something that takes us away from what the founders envisioned, what the founders created, which is a country that respects the rule of law and the balance of powers. The third branch, by the way, being the judicial branch and the head of the judicial branch. We have courts all over the country, you know, from, you know, small local courts, state courts, all the way up to federal, and then ultimately the Supreme Court, which is the highest court in the land, which has nine justices, four of which are conservative, four of which are ultra-leftist. One is, God only knows what he is from moment to moment, but the four conservatives being Justice Antonin Scalia, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and the fourth usually being Justice Roberts. Now, that doesn't always happen to be the case, but point is, Scalia and Thomas are sound. Alito's been conservative as well. Roberts has jumped around a little bit, but he typically falls in line with the conservatives. But the point is, there's still four ultra leftists over there. And this is where you get rulings, the four leftists and sometimes Roberts, the four leftists and the guy in the middle who floats around almost aimlessly from time to time. This is where you get decisions that encroach upon our freedoms and our liberties, that are anti-constitutional. You know, I've stopped using the term unconstitutional. I think it needs to be called anti-constitutional. Sounds a little bit more aggressive, because that's what it is. I mean, you have justices on the Supreme Court who will tell you that they should cite foreign law in making their decision. I mean, how absurd is that? I mean, we might as well start let them, you know, cite. If you're going to stop, why foreign law? Why not stop with something you read on the way into work that morning? Why not base it upon the flip of a coin, a reading of your daily horoscope? But my point is, there's a lot of problems with our government, and much of the problem are lifelong politicians I really believe this. I believe that lifelong politicians or career politicians, those that have been there for multiple years, are a major contributing factor to the problem. Even those that went there with good conservative principles. Because what happens is, and I don't know exactly what happens, but in general what happens is they get there, they get into the clique, they get into the club, and all of a sudden the idea doesn't become liberal versus conservative. It becomes my buddy Chuck Schumer's idea. And I don't want to attack Chuck Schumer. You know, we had coffee last week. He's a nice guy. I met his wife. His kids seem good. You know, we went to the Washington Capitals hockey game last week, or we caught a Washington Wizards basketball game. I helped shovel the snow off his driveway, the 24 or 30 inches of snow he's getting, which we might talk a little bit about that. But we act like this huge snowfalls. Now, that is a high amount, but there have been big snowfalls in D.C. before. It's not as though this is San Diego, California. I mean, we act as though this place never gets snow. When I was there in 1999, there was a snowstorm. I think we got right around a foot of snow. Granted, a foot is not 24 inches. It isn't, by the way, if you're a liberal listening to the broadcast. But they get to D.C. and they begin to see these people as individuals, which, look, I have no problem with that. I'm not saying to go there, you know, with the intent on destroying and harming and just totally attacking these folks who have different political beliefs. That's what the left does. That's where they come in and attack on personal levels and destroy people and their families. There's no need for that. Fine, but attack their ideology and go there to win. Go there to win. Win for conservatism. Win for the Constitution. Win for the future of this country. You're not there to make friends. I'm not saying you're there to make enemies necessarily, but I tell you what, if you stand up on principle, you're going to make enemies. Live with it. If you can't deal with that, then don't run for Congress. Don't run for the White House. Politicians talk as though most Americans want them to reach across the aisle. That's not what I want. That's not what most conservatives want. I want the government to be restored to its proper position and order. I want it to be limited. I want it to have its hands out of everything that I'm doing. And this takes a strong, committed, principled leader. And you've by no doubt seen by this point, by now, or heard about this National Review article. I guess you could call it the case against Donald Trump. It prints out to 4 pages off my printer. It's not a really long read, but it's not a short read, but it's not overwhelmingly daunting. And you'll have noticed, if you have paid attention, that some of the names involved in this, I don't have an extensive list here in front of me, but I know that there's Glenn Beck. He was a contributor, one of the editors that contributed to or reviewed this article, put their name to it. Dana Lesh is one. Andrew McCarthy, who I really respect, is one of these guys. There's lots of others. That Thomas Sowell, fantastic, brilliant. One of the guys that I have the utmost respect for, Thomas Sowell. But there's a lot. There's Katie Pavlich from Town Hall, I think, is where she is, where she's from. You see her on Fox News. Brent Bozell. In fact, last night on the Kelly File on Fox News, I actually saw Dana Lesh, Brent Bozell, and Katie Pavlich actually talk about this article, talk about why conservatives should reject a Donald Trump presidency. And they lay it out here in four pages, and we'll go through this a little bit. We'll go through this. But this is, look, there are good points in here. There's a few things that I think are a little bit I don't know. Not the strongest argument, and not the, I don't know. It's just not the way I would have gone about it. But that being said, I mean, there's definitely issues. And this, in that sense, this is a good thing. I mean, that is the whole point of the nomination process. I mean, there is a battle for control of the Republican Party. On one side are the conservatives, on the other side are the establishment folks. But it gets a lot trickier than that, because then we have to say, what makes someone a conservative? We just saw this week, earlier this week, Sarah Palin endorsed Donald Trump, which Sarah Palin at one point was, I would argue, synonymous with. I don't want to necessarily say the face of, but you could make the case that she was a face for the Tea Party. I mean, those people, the Tea Party crowd, and look, I'm removing myself from this story. I am trying to be objective here. This is about ideas, and there are good ideas. There are good cases against Trump. This is not a, you know, there's any politician is going to have things that you could attack. I mean, we're human beings. We're human beings, and we have good characteristics and bad characteristics. We have, anytime we deviate from conservatism, we have bad policies, bad positions on issues. And they lay forth some of these things that they want the reader to take away. And I'm sure, no doubt, if they haven't already, I don't have the time to follow each of these individual folks closely. You know, listen to Dana Lesh or Glenn Beck or Eric Erickson. I don't really have the time to listen to them intently like maybe some of you do. I don't know. I don't have the time to do that right now, given my full plate with the businesses and this and the podcast and, of course, the three little ones here and coaching basketball now. But my point is, they are probably going to run with this, and they probably have been making the case against Trump. But then on the other side, you've got, like I said, Sarah Palin, who's endorsed Trump. You've got Ann Coulter, who has endorsed Trump. You have, look, I don't know if Hannity's come out and endorsed Trump, but it's pretty obvious to me that Hannity's strongly considering supporting Donald Trump. I saw Herman Cain on Hannity a couple of days ago saying that the top three candidates in his mind were Trump, Cruz, and Rubio, and I don't think he was saying in any particular order. He was just saying those are the three. Of course, those are the three leaders, but anyway, there's a war. There's a war for control of the party, and it's getting a little convoluted and confusing. Whose side is who, you know, are each of these folks on? What represents conservatism? Now, interestingly, these folks who came out did not come out and endorse a candidate. My guess is that all, 15 or 20 of these folks, however many is on here, do not support the same candidate. Billy Crystal is another one, Bill Crystal, from National Review, who contributed, who was an editor, signed off as an editor of this article. Not really sure that he's a Ted Cruz guy. Some of these folks are definitely going to be Ted Cruz guys, which in my mind, look, if you're making the straight conservative argument, if you're making the straight argument that we want someone who's going to stand in line with conservative principles and the things that the Tea Party has supported, which is in this article, incidentally, then to me, in my estimation, your best option is Ted Cruz. And that doesn't mean that some of these others haven't had Tea Party moments, that all these other folks are anti-constitutional like the hardcore left is, like Hillary Clinton, the nutty professor Bernie Sanders, and sexy, sexy, sexy Martin O'Malley. That doesn't mean that. It just means that Ted Cruz is, in my estimation, is a true believer, is a true constitutionalist. Now, there's going to be those who come out and point to his natural-born citizenship issue, there's going to be those that, and you see them, that point to the Goldman Sachs relationship and these loans and so forth. And Trump's using those to drive a wedge between Cruz and his support. He's trying to build a firewall to win the nomination and beginning with Iowa here in, what, 10 days? Now, for those of us, for those conservatives that support Ted Cruz as their primary candidate, could we give answers to these objections? I believe so. But there's some that have determined he's ineligible to run, that he is corrupt. He's part of the problem in D.C. I don't see it that way at all. But there's some, and just because someone believes that does not mean that they're not a conservative. You know, just because someone would pick Marco Rubio over Ted Cruz does not mean they're necessarily not a conservative. It's just that they value some of the other things that Rubio may, in their mind, be better at, I don't know, implementing or standing for or what have you, communicating. But this article overall, I mean, it lays forth a case against Trump. I think in a few places it doesn't do it very well, but I think overall, I mean, it hits the main issues, which, starting with, you know, immigration, which that's the one that Trump really became universally adorned, at least as far as his voter base is concerned. That's where he developed a huge support. And then, of course, just his approach, his non-political, non-PC approach, which they kind of attack in this article as being, you know, unpresidential, unworthy of the office, painting him as a hothead. And there are people that believe this, people that think this. But we're in a battle for control of the Republican Party, and this is good. I mean, there was a point in time, I saw Bob Dole come out, what, yesterday or the day before, did he endorse Jeb? I don't know I think he endorsed Jeb. But there was a time when those were the only candidates we had to pick from. People that were the wimpy moderate types. I mean, Bob Dole was the first, pains me to say this, but Bob Dole was the first vote I cast in a presidential election. 1996, he was on the ballot against, Bill Clinton. I wasn't excited to do that. I mean, it was my first time to vote, so that was exciting, but now we've got people that inspire. And Trump is an inspirational figure, and you know, think of that what you may. You may think that he's as awful. You may be full on board with this National Review article, or you may be one that's standing with his diehard supporters. You may be a diehard supporter. So anyway, there's a battle here, and it's raging. And on the eve of the Iowa caucuses, I mean, we're at the 11th hour now. We're down to the nitty-gritty. This is where we're going to see if people can be persuaded. Can Trump continue the momentum? Does this hurt him? Is this offset by Sarah Palin? I mean, I don't know. We'll see. But anyway, we're going to get into this article just a bit when we get back, but we're going to stop and take a break, so be back in just a minute. Make sure your booster shots are up to date by signing up for our free monthly email newsletter. It's educational, it's fun, and it's free. Sign up today by going to theantidotetoliberalism.com/newsletter. That's theantidotetoliberalism.com/newsletter. For you, the listeners of The Antidote to Liberalism, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. I've been a member of Audible since May of 2014, and I love it. I've listened to novels, books on business, political books, you name it. In fact, one of my most recent downloads was given to me by one of our listeners, Ben Carson's America the Beautiful. What a good man and solid presidential candidate. But if you'd rather check out a great novel instead, I highly recommend The Twelfth Imam by Joel Rosenberg. Of course, you'll want to get the rest of his books in the series after that, too. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/antidote. Again, that's audibletrial.com/antidote for your free audiobook. There's nothing to lose with this free trial, so why not give it a try? Welcome back to The Antidote to Liberalism. I am your host, Todd Huff. Today is Friday. It is January 22nd. It's a pleasure to be here. By the way, we mentioned this yesterday. Big weekend for the NFL. New England Patriots travel to Denver, play the Denver Broncos in the AFC Championship. Peyton Manning, Tom Brady, number, 17. Maybe the last time these two play. Actually, probably will be the last time that these two play. And then in the NFC, we have the Arizona Cardinals traveling to Carolina, traveling to, Charlotte to play the Carolina Panthers. Cam Newton versus Carson Palmer, the first time two Heisman Trophy winning candidates, or excuse me, quarterbacks, thinking politics here, candidates. First time that the two former Heisman Trophy winners have met, I believe I heard this, in an NFC or in a championship game. So, big weekend. I have great interest in this. The NFL, while it's doing its best to turn people like me away with some of the rules, and I get, you know, player safety. I'm not against player safety, but it is a contact sport. It is a physical, high-impact, at times violent sport. And that's what attracts folks. Folks like me, anyway. A lot of us go to the UFC, which, if it ever gets to the mainstream, which it's getting huge, but if it ever moves into the mainstream like football did, like the NFL did, you will see much different rules in the UFC as well. But regardless, big weekend in the NFL, can't wait for that. But back to this article about Donald Trump. You know, the first attack, first of all, they acknowledge that, hey, this guy has been a skillful campaigner. He knows how to woo an audience. He knows how to get people, you know, cheering for him. He's filling big stadiums with people cheering his name, chanting USA, what have you. He knows how to pull that off. But the question is he a conservative? Should he be the nominee of the GOP, of the Republican Party? Or is he just a populist? Is he someone who's become a reality TV star? I'm reporting what this article says. I'm not taking a side candidly at this point. I'm just telling you what it says. But they attack his lack of consistency on his political beliefs. And they cite abortion because he supported abortion before. He supported gun control before. He's supported and spoken highly of a single-payer healthcare system like Canada, punitive taxes for the wealthy. And the starting argument is, hey, this is a wolf in sheep's clothing. This is a guy who's benefiting from the momentum that the Tea Party has gotten, the return to constitutional conservative values. And just because he's espousing some conservative ideas from time to time, which, by the way, they'll argue here is not consistent across the board. There's gaping holes, as they say here in the article, gaping holes in it. Talks about immigration. Talks about how a couple of years ago he criticized Mitt Romney for talking about self-deportation. Talks about the inconsistency of his position on he talks about decreasing legal immigration, but then he goes ahead and advocates something that would increase legal immigration. So they're attacking his inconsistencies. And even Trump supporters, even those that are diehard believers who are really on board with him, will, I think, admit that he has said some things that are not consistent. But is that enough to to get people to say, look, the ride's been fun. I'm going to get behind someone else. I don't know. And another thing to think about is the people that are reading the National Review, are they the ones that – are they Trump supporters? I mean, I don't know. I can't imagine. I don't read the National Review on a regular basis. I'm familiar with it. But I can't imagine they've had high praise for Donald Trump in other articles. But regardless, they seem to suggest that they don't really buy into Donald Trump's, I don't know, his tough immigration talk, I guess. You have to couple this, by the way. Earlier this week, what was his son, Eric Trump, came out with a statement basically saying that his dad's plan would build a wall, but it would also include amnesty. He used the word amnesty. Now, is Eric Trump the spokesman? I mean, is that – I mean, there's all sorts of questions that arise from this, but the bottom line is – there's definitely questions that are swirling around about here. Now, they go on to attack the possibility of deporting 11 million illegal aliens in the United States, calling it a Herculean administration and logistical task beyond the capacity of the federal government. You know, you hear this a lot, and look, Trump will say we're going to deport everybody. But I have a question. I mean, what is the alternative? Is the alternative? I mean, you either deport or you create some sort of amnesty, even if it's just amnesty by default. I mean, either you let people stay here or you try to deport them. I mean, do I think anyone really believes that 100% of these illegal aliens will be deported? No, I don't believe that. But do I believe that deportation is some crazy idea? No, I don't believe that at all. I mean, there have been times in American history where several million folks were deported or self-deported due to fears of deportation. And this is actually a job that's a legitimate responsibility of the federal government. I mean, maybe, just maybe, if our government wasn't so concerned about the height of sinks and public restrooms, people building on their own private property, shutting it down because they say it's building in a floodplain. The only reason it was a floodplain was because the creek had big trees that fell down in it, blocking the flow of water so that the water flooded into the field. Once the trees were removed, the water moved freely out, did not pond. In fact, it was bone dry down to, 6 or 8 feet where this guy was digging his basement. But the feds were involved in that, saying he couldn't build there because it's a floodplain. I mean, there's all these little areas that the government is all into everybody's business. Obama's going to hire more FBI agents to make sure that this new background check system for guns is going to be running smoothly. Someone's going to be putting this fingerprint technology on handguns, thanks to Obama's decree, his edict, his fatwa. But this is actually a legitimate role, and I know those that have written this article agree with this. I mean, they're constitutional believers. They're just questioning whether they can do it. And look, if you're going to say that the federal government is inept, I mean, hey, preaching to the choir on that one. I know that they're inept, but this is something that if we can make a major dent in this. I'm not going to make predictions on how much, but the idea that just because we cannot deport 100% doesn't mean that we shouldn't deport those that we should is just a little bit weak to me. I mean, it really is. But building a wall, building, and the wall is just, wall is symbolic for whatever keeps that border from allowing people to come in. I mean, whether there's other surveillance and technology involved. There has to be a physical barrier. There has to be a way to monitor people. I mean, you know, this is a good-sized border. And there's got to be a way to you know, to do other things to monitor people that may be trying to get across the border. It's not just building a wall and, you know, calling it a day. I mean, we've got to be vigilant and just protecting that, making sure that no one's coming across illegally. I mean, there could be ISIS, but we've seen people stopped on the border that are from the Middle East. In fact, if I believe we've stopped people that we think have ties to ISIS. I'd have to look into that. But, I mean, the idea that no one from ISIS is smart enough to exploit this weakness is just pure folly. If they haven't, they will. And the chances are they probably have. Someone with ISIS sympathies or ISIS beliefs has come across that border. That's a very fair assessment. But moving past that, moving past the wall, moving past deportation, they call Trump a nationalist, which, you know, think what you will about that. But they say he's inconsistent. Like, one minute he'll say he wants to let ISIS be fought by Russia. The next minute he wants to bomb the you-know-what out of ISIS. Talks about stealing Iraq's oil, his fixation on that. When in reality, I mean, I get what they're saying, but in reality, he's saying that we bore the cost of that war, and that the Iraqis should have compensated us with, well, he said the oil. And maybe he's wrong, maybe he's right. Look, the point is that there are some issues that are legitimate against Trump. There's others that I'm not so sure are just nothing more than a little bit of desperation. But, you know, look, here's the real deal. If conservatives, if the Tea Party crowd, if those of us that believe in a restoration of constitutional principles, balance of power, if we've developed this movement, as a lot of these folks here were instrumental in doing, if we've developed this movement and then we look up and we believe that someone who's benefiting from that movement, who says the right things, who takes on the appearance that he is the outsider, like the Tea Party, like the constitutional conservatives, and he sneaks into the crowd and gets the support of those who believe he's a true believer, a true constitutional conservative, a true Tea Party type, because he's got that anti-establishment, that bravado, that non-PC appeal. And then he gets in and he governs as though he's not at all like what he said he was, like what he took on the appearance of, then that is going to be damaging, very damaging to the movement. Because then people will say, what's the difference? They're all the same. We elected a guy that the Tea Party told us, even though they didn't directly, but they developed in us this desire to look for certain qualities. We thought we found it in this guy, and he gets into office, and wow, what a mess we have. And then they said, there's no point in being involved. I'm just going to live my life and not vote again. I mean, that's a very real concern. And the question is that Trump? Is that what defines Donald Trump, or is it not? But they get a little bit childish on attacking Donald Trump here about, it says, for someone who wants to project strength, he has an astonishing weakness for flattery, falling for Vladimir Putin after he batted his eyelashes. You know, I don't know. I mean, whatever. However you have to try to communicate your point, but I'm not necessarily thinking that's the best way to do it. We'll make fun of people on here. Political enemies, you know, Jihadi Joe Donnelly. I mean, he's one that stands in stark contrast to what we believe. He supported President Obama's Iran nuke deal. And so we came up with the song Jihadi Joe, and we have fun with it. But I think there's truth there. This one, to me, just comes across a little bit silly. But nonetheless, they're saying that Trump really isn't as tough as he seems to be, and proof being in how he falls for the flattery of Vladimir Putin. They say that Trump makes these big promises that don't really have any substance to them. So essentially, Washington's full of problems. I'm a problem solver. Let me go solve them. And look, there may be truth in this. Here's the issue for me. Communication, to be a good communicator, you have to be able to put the cookies on the bottom shelf. You have to be able to say something succinctly. You don't have time to make a dissertation. You have to come up with ways to effectively communicate the essence of what you stand for. You don't always have the ability to drill down into every single minutia. People won't listen, so it doesn't matter at that point what you're saying because you're not being heard. The other part of the equation is to be heard, to be understood, of course, as well. But there has to be substance behind the ideas as someone who believes in the power of ideas. And that's really the question. Is Trump just a masterful presenter of the one line, or is there substance behind this? And if there is substance, is it conservative substance? And they raise legitimate questions, and these things have to be considered. There's a lot at stake here. I would maintain more at stake here, I think definitely than any election in my lifetime, and maybe any election in quite some time, because of what we've had, because of the movement, the doubling of the federal debt, the fundamental transformation that Barack Obama's ushered in, the abuse of powers. So they question his campaign style. They say he has an obsession with winning, regardless of what that means, a spirit that is anathema to the ordered liberty that conservatives hold dear and that depends for its preservation on limits of government power. I don't think that winning is an anathema to liberty. In fact, I think that we need to win. But their point is, he talks only about winning in the sense of what are we winning at, you know? Or what are we trying? Where are our victories? And a conservative needs to hear, we all need to hear as Americans, even if we don't believe it, that part of winning is a returning to constitutional values. And that's really, I think, what their attack here for Trump is, because you don't hear those things. You might hear those things, but then they'll say that they're not substantive enough. And that's for you to decide. They also attack him as being, last thing, I'm going to wrap up here, but they attack him for saying, hey, look, this guy is running for president. He has no political experience. This is not an entry-level position. And leadership is not, as they put it, I disagree with this, by the way. They say the burdens and intricacies of leadership are special. Okay, I agree with that. Experience in other fields is not transferable. Now, that's not true. In fact, if you read these people that lead major corporations, a lot of times they don't know anything or very little about the specific industry. It's about leadership. It's about inspiring people. But to their overarching point, which is Trump needs to understand and embrace the Constitution, if they don't believe that that's the case, now that's a legitimate problem. The question is, are they right, or is Ann Coulter right? Is Sarah Palin right? Is, I think, Sean Hannity's on the Trump side, is he right? But the fight is good. The fight is what's going to flush these things out. In fact, I would argue it's better to... The alternative back when I was younger, and even before that, was that you dealt with whatever candidate was there. Most people, I mean, could people tell you what a filibuster was? Could people tell you what, the electoral college was? How many electoral votes each state had? There were periods of time when people had no idea about this. But they do now, because these things have been brought to the forefront. And now we have to make the next right step, the next correct decision. And Iowa's a first step at that, but that is just the beginning, because this thing is far from over. So anyway, if you haven't read the article, I encourage you to check it out. It's like I said, it prints right to four pages. It's not flattering to Trump at all. And I encourage, you know, those of you that support Trump, don't be afraid to read this. Don't be afraid to read this. For those of you that hate Trump, I mean, you know, give this a legitimate consideration. There's some good points in here, and I think they need to be considered. But there's some things that I think it's not worthy of putting in here, in my estimation. But anyway, some very, very brilliant conservative minds, people that I respect very highly, most of them anyway, and the case against Donald Trump. Regardless of your position here, this is a critical decision that we face. You know, whether you're a Trump supporter or whether you're a Cruz supporter or whoever else, this is a critical decision. I mean, America truly hangs in the balance. Are we going to continue down the path of transformation that Barack Obama has taken us down? Or are we going to return to what's made America truly great, which is freedom, the principles set forth in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, constitutional conservatism, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, property? This battle's important. So anyway, I'm going to wrap up for the day. As always, guys, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for joining us. Email, should you want to reach out to me, is todd@theantidotetoliberalism.com, or you can connect with me on Twitter. Twitter hashtag is @CommonSenseGear. So anyway, guys, have a great day, and we will see you soon. Take care.
Thank you for listening to The Antidote to Liberalism. Your inoculations are now up to date. But since the disease of liberalism is ubiquitous and highly contagious, we need to see you again tomorrow. In the meantime, to help you boost your immunity, please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast.